17th. This is LA Podcast. The month of June is almost over. Our June gloom is halfway lifted.
We've got Alyssa Walker, Scott Frazier, and Hayes Davenport here. And
early morning podcast. While the city sleeps.
Yeah.
The Heroes Podcast.
Right. Throwback to when we did our Wildcat review of the movie Nightcrawler.
Yes, that's right. Fun stuff to talk about this week and some not very fun stuff, as always. Does anyone have a cool L.A. story? Mine is cool.
Mine is not that cool, so I guess I'll go first.
Yeah, okay, good.
I found out that my rent is going up this week.
Yes.
And I had a conniption about it online. But
and the city was like, oh, like, we're so sorry.
No problem, Scott. Just keep it the same.
L.A. tenants have something that is called rent stabilization. Most L.A. tenants do. About three quarters, according to the city's housing department.
Any building built before 1979 is rent stabilized.
Which makes no sense, but go on.
So rent stabilization means that there are regulations dictating how often your landlord can raise your rent and by how much. The way that they determine how much you can have your you can raise your rent if you are a landlord is by looking at the annual change in the consumer price index for the LA region. This past year, for the first time in 10 years, that was about 4%. So I think that previously the increases were 3%, which is the minimum allowable. It goes on a sliding scale between 3 and 8%. But it's been 3% for the past 10 years.
Yep.
So this is something that was reported on by Curbed earlier in the spring. But I think
I never thought it would happen to me.
For myself and and for, I think, probably a lot of other tenants, it was sort of like, you know, it's not something that you're actually aware of until you get a notice that your rent is going up. That was certainly the case for me. I just assumed that it was incorrect. And then I found the Curbed article from March. Like, I'm not looking for information about that, generally speaking. So the term of this increase is from July to June So it's just now. My landlord was apparently super excited to know that they could raise my rent by 4% instead of the customary 3, because my increases are not actually legal until October. And they raised my rent by about 4.5%, which is still, can't do.
Why? Well, so they can't raise it by 4.5% any month.
No.
Why is your rent increase not legal until October? Because that's when your lease began or something?
Yeah, because you can only... So the RSO says that landlords can only increase rent once in a 12-month period.
Yep.
So my last increase was in October.
Yep.
But this apparently just like overstimulated my landlord so much that she was like, I'm sending this out to all my tenants right away. Now I'm having to talk to my tenant, my fellow neighbors about how we respond to this.
Uh-huh.
It would be
not
great.
Your favorite thing to do.
It would be I love my neighbors. It would be great if we could engage in some sort of like tenant organizing effort. But of course, that's not legal. Right. It's not going to be legal.
Unfortunately, no.
But I think that this is interesting, given that the timing is interesting, given the fact that we just got the homeless count results recently. One of the things that I was saying online last week is that the city council has repeatedly said Sacramento is tying our hands. There's nothing that we can do about housing affordability unless or until the state legislature does something about the Ellis Act, which allows for no-fault evictions, the Costa-Hawkins Act, which limits the ability of local governments to implement rent control. Unless those things happen, that there's nothing that the city can do about housing affordability, which is not true. And I'd seen it commented as such so many places by so many different officials, notably by David Rue, council member of the 4th District, and his spokesperson in the Los Feliz Ledger, that this was the case. They can't do anything. Costa-Hawkins is the law of the land, et cetera. Then I just wanted to point out the fact that Costa-Hawkins actually doesn't say anything about what rent control can look like, other than the fact that you can't have vacancy controls. So that's why in smaller cities than LA, cities like West Hollywood and Santa Monica and San Francisco, rent control is actually stronger, by which I mean the controls are tighter on what the rent changes can be than they are in the city of Los Angeles. And so if the city of Los Angeles wanted to say, like, the increases in rent have been 3% every year for the past decade, and people are very used to that. Landlords are very used to that. We're in a low inflation environment. We don't expect that to change.
And homelessness is exploding. And we've just been talking all week about how it is a housing affordability issue.
Right. They could change that anytime that they wanted to. The RSO is a city ordinance. They can change this whenever they want. And Costa-Hawkins doesn't tie their hands for that. But it does seem like it's just a way for them to sort of wash their hands of having to do anything whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So that was my LA story of being mad online.
I'm sure we all have
an
those
ongoing
from
saga.
This week. Yeah. Alyssa, what's going on?
I think ours are related. So why don't you start and I'll piggyback.
Okay. So I got a DM. Always the beginning of a great story. Never works.
Not
out
a BM.
No, I got a DM.
DM. Okay.
It went down in the DMs this week from a guy named Ian Rose, listener to LA Podcast. And he said, hey, I'm a fan of the show. I love the show. He's does some kind of science-y thing. I forget exactly what. And he says, unrelated, I got a package that is addressed to you.
What? He received
That's what it. I said. And I was like, oh, this is very scary. Like, what's going on here? It is just a total coincidence. His building got a package that they misdelivered. And the FedEx truck came this week and, like, called me out of the house and was like, we have a package for you. And then they looked around in the truck and they're like, oh, I guess we didn't bring it. We'll be back tomorrow. And then I get a message later that day from an LA podcast listener saying, hey, they accidentally.
Now our listeners are acting as curious.
Delivered it to the wrong building. Podcasting finally pays off for me. This is why you do a local podcast. If you do a national one, your listeners are less likely to be able to deliver your packages for you. And he dropped it off. He was so nice. And that it's a relevant LA story because it was my new nutcase helmet to replace the one that I lost during the. So to catch people up,
I didn't hear this story. You lost your
But I replaced it with the exact same one. Last month, I decided that I had lived too long, and so I was going to scoot and bike and take transit everywhere instead of driving.
Yeah.
Just to update people on how that went. I did not do it. I didn't even come super close. I would say I drove on average like twice a week.
Okay.
And the reason it happened every time. So people like.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not
like,
bad for
like
a
could
normal.
Just be you could just do that.
Twice a week?
Just keep trying that only twice a week.
That's not bad for a normal person. I will say that's good for a normal person.
Yeah.
I would say keep to that ratio.
But how many trips do you think you were taking total per week? Because this is my whole thing. How many trips did you track your total trips?
Like
your percentage of trips that you took driving. We can talk about this later. You can do some math.
I don't know exactly.
Because as long as you're below 50%, I think that's really good.
Well, you were definitely below 50.
And you know, and then if you also factor in all your ride share, I mean, it's not really good, but I'm saying like as long as a majority of your trips are not in cars. Yeah.
I think that it's not even that it's bad for you. It's that it's bad
for
like,
someone who is trying not.
It's
to
bad that it's like
drive at all.
If you're trying not to drive at all, that's how hard it is, basically.
So part of it is
no judgment.
Being someone who has to lug podcasting equipment around the city for increasingly your living. So I like sometimes it does fit in a backpack, but sometimes for like a really long ride or something. And when it's really hot.
It was really hot this week.
Yeah, this week. It's just harder to like to justify it. But the big reason people ask a lot. How to increase the amount of time that they take transit. And for me, the reason I wasn't doing it was always because I planned wrong or like waited too long or something. A bunch of times I painstakingly took a bus to where I was going and realized I was in the wrong place and supposed to be in the valley or something. And then you have to get in a car right away. There's no way to
rectify
close
that
gap. Yeah. In any other way. So it's all planning. It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be something that you have to like the night before just like lay out your whole agenda just to get to where you're going.
Yeah.
But that is kind of what it requires. Is that your experience, Alyssa, as someone who primarily travels this way?
It's planning, but also just knowing where you're going, I think, is 90% of it. But I think factoring in sometimes going to the destination several hours early and finding a place to work or something nearby often works for me.
Something that I've tried a
lot. And this is what I've found too.
Or off-peak times.
I think there are a couple different profiles of people who ride transit, rely on transit to get most places in the city. And one is the person who literally has no other option and therefore like those decisions are much higher consequence. Like if you, and probably you're not making a ton of trips that you don't have to at that point. So it's probably a lot of regular back and forth travel. But at the same time, if you do get something wrong, it's a lot higher stakes. Like you could be losing a job, you could be, you know, what have you. And then I would say the second type of person that is relying on transit to get most places, a camp that I would count myself in, is a person who has considerably more flexibility in their schedules. Because realistically, even Metro, I think that I've said this before on this podcast, but I'm not sure. Metro is doing their next gen transit planning study right now. And one of the things that they're looking at is they want to increase the number of transit trips that can be done in less than twice as long as the corresponding car trip. So if that's the benchmark for a successful transit trip, according to our local transit agency,
very ambitious.
Yeah, it's
we aspire to be less than half the double speed. As bad.
Yeah. half the speed would be just fine with Metro. And the fact of the matter is most transit trips are not that. So I've said online before, I generally speaking a lot like an hour to do most of the transit trips. And that is enough time. But it's like if you don't have an hour to give in your schedule, then it's kind of like if things don't break the right way for you in your daily schedule and you have an alternative, you're probably going to end up taking the alternative.
Yeah. But this is the thing that has been so life-changing for me about the scooters and the jump bikes and stuff is if you make a transit mistake or if just as often they do, the thing doesn't show up or whatever.
It's forgiving. The system is
exactly.
forgiving.
You can just hop on the
provided thing, you can find one. Yeah.
That is faster than the bus.
Yes.
I've raced many buses crushed them.
It can be faster than buses. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think I also got mad online about headways this week.
That should be the name of the podcast. So,
I posted something about we were going to my daughter's preschool graduation. It wasn't her graduating, but we were going to watch the graduating class graduate.
Yeah.
You know, they have the gowns and everything for 4-year-olds. Just kidding. But we missed it because the bus, it was a short ceremony. The bus said it was coming. We waited for one bus. It didn't come. We waited to begin with, the first headway, it said it was coming in 32 minutes.
Yeah,
so I said, okay, that's fine. We'll just make it if we take this bus coming in 32 minutes on a Saturday. Even like on a Saturday morning, which I still feel like it's still pretty good service anyway. But so we waited. It didn't come. I'm like twittering with Metro service people being like, no signs posted. What's going on? And I guess it was construction that they just didn't post signs for. And it was because I could see the bus ending up further down. It was like going around us. But again, not a big deal for us. We just went home and said we'd see the graduation next year. And but then as we walked back home, there were at every bus stop standing in no shade, four older adults who were going to work, going to medical appointments, going to see their kids. We talked to every single one of them as we were going back. Don't have smartphones, or maybe if they did, couldn't see what I could see. Don't have a direct line to Metro like I do. And no signs up. And some of them, you know, obviously not English speakers. I was just like, I was livid walking back to my house. I just was like, we have failed in every way possible.
Yeah.
All these people, I don't care about me. All these people who have had their Saturdays now ruined.
Yeah.
Failures.
I would say like riding transit in LA is, I think that in terms that we've been talking about it, it's very unforgiving. It really is. And the headways are a perfect example of that. If you spend a lot of time talking to people about transit or why they don't ride transit, people bring up headways almost immediately because I think really because of this notion of riding the bus, riding the train should be forgiving. When I was taking grad school courses at Cal State LA and I was getting out of class at like 9 p.m., I would take the Silver Line mm-hmm. back to Union Station, and just so many times had this experience where I would get off the Silver Line bus, literally sprint down to the Red Line platform, only to just miss it. Yeah. And then the next train is coming in 25 minutes.
The squealing of the brakes as it pulls out.
And you
know you're too late.
The feeling is like this is extremely unforgivable. Like you should not feel like you're being punished yeah. for barely missing a connection or for missing a bus. And that is really like the experience yeah. of riding transit.
The best is when you already tapped to go down and get to it. Oh, and yeah. then it's gone. And it's not going to be there for 25
yeah,
minutes.
The arrivals so. Yeah. aren't. I will say the real time arrivals on the Red Line, at least, instead of having horrible numbers, they've just set them to the scheduled numbers,
which is smart.
Yeah, which is smart, but also somewhat deceiving right. if the which train is actually coming. But it's yeah. better than the alternative what it was before.
Yep.
I also just wanted to mention another getting mad. I wasn't really mad, but I'm trying to get to the bottom of this. Talking about bikes and scooters, Jump raised its rates for yep. its permanent rates, and I didn't know what the price of the scooter was before. Oh wait, no, scooters were a $1 unlock fee, and then used to be 15 cents, and bikes had a free unlock fee and a minute rate of 15 cents. And e-bikes are going up to 30 cents a minute, still free to unlock, and scooters are going up to 26 cents per minute. And when I posted that, a bunch of people in other cities were like, oh, mine went up too. Mm-hmm. So I emailed Uber's like press people. And what is interesting is they are saying that it is because of LADOT's permitting structure that they have to increase their prices, and their explanation of like per service, per device fee, and that they have to respond to calls to retrieve scooters and bikes within 2 hours per the 311 requirements that we've talked about, where mm-hmm. you if something's right. like improperly parked. And then it says in total, it will cost us more than $500,000 in fees to operate here for the next 12 months. In comparison, it cost us $17,200 for a permit in Sacramento last year.
That's interesting. Does that include basically the tax? So there were stats went out this week.
So that's what I was going to say. Let's go into this information.
This I saw these were shared by Greg Spotts, who's the assistant director of the Bureau of Street Services on Twitter. So in city of LA, scooters and e-bikes, there's 36,000 total permitted vehicles. Checks out. They're all over the place. 17,000 and a half actual deployed ones so far. That's like the daily average. Six operators, $3.2 million in city revenue collected, and 1.86 million trips. That's a lot.
That revenue is over what period?
That revenue
permit process started. So that would be, was it March?
Yeah.
Wow, that is surprising. That's a lot.
And an average length of 1.2 miles, which okay. is
exactly the same as everybody. Yeah, as they've always said.
Yeah.
So that's interesting in light of, we talked about the per device fee, right? So you can, if you deploy a device in a disadvantaged community, one that is underserved by transit or has certain income requirements, it's the $39 fee. This is, I'm just using Jump's numbers. I don't know if it's the same for yep. all of them. And if you deploy it in a anywhere else area, it's $130. So they could deploy a lot more vehicles if they, for a cheaper price, if they put them in disadvantaged communities. And what we're seeing is actually not a lot of those. Like in the Valley, for example, it's been a little bit slower deployment, like East LA, uh-huh. places like South LA. You just don't see as many devices being deployed. So I'm curious about their strategy when it comes to, you know, paying what, how many times 39 compared to $130?
Yeah, I have heard that they would, you know, they prefer to pay the, I mean, and that matches up with what we're seeing. They would prefer to pay more and avoid just like dumping their vehicles in places that they perceive as like either not going to get as many rides or that they just don't want to leave a bunch of vehicles in, for example, South LA for whatever reason. And I think that is troubling, but it's also like, this is kind of, it comes with the territory with these like private mobility companies. And I think that there's been kind of like a sugar high of like, it really does close the gaps in our transportation network in a lot of ways. But you also have a lot of issues that you don't have with public transit operators, even existing, like pre-existing private operators like taxi companies are not allowed to operate in some of the ways that we're talking about Uber and Lyft operating, could not unilaterally decide to raise the amount that it costs to ride a taxi basically overnight and with no notice or like not equal notice or not public notice. So it's weird that they're being allowed to operate in this way. It's very weird to me.
I mean, you know, my belief that the Uber and Lyft vehicles should be included under MDS, under this data plan. And I think we should be tracking and, you know, doing all the same things, being able to report vehicles that are in our bike lanes in the same way for 301, things like that. But I do think it's interesting now that the number of trips, which we all, our jaws kind of all dropped to hear, you know, and the number of people, I do think people are riding these, and I see people of all different backgrounds and all different neighborhoods riding these. I mean, a lot.
Right. And so, now, I mean, school's out and the kids are going wild.
Kids aren't supposed to be riding
on the
them.
Wheels.
Just
they
FYI,
love
kids,
those little wheels bikes.
You have to be 18. Well, yeah, at the same time, we say, oh, there's, you know, they're not putting them in these other neighborhoods. Yet there are, the corner of where I work in Hollywood, probably 300 wheels bikes at any given time lined up like for the entire block from one end to the other. So there's probably too many devices in some of the higher income neighborhoods, and they could just scoot those somewhere else for a little bit. But it's interesting to see the ridership is there. People are doing it. It's a bummer that they're trying to say that the permitting is causing them to raise rates, if that is actually true, or if they're just trying to become profitable.
That was Uber or
this was Jump. Yeah, Uber Jump. They also just had an IPO, so just keep that in mind.
Right. And I think that was my first thought, and I think probably a bunch of people who saw your tweet, was that it was a response to their, I actually think Lauren Nelson of The Times said this online too, like this is probably part of a push to make their company actually profitable. But it is noteworthy that they're not doing this on the much larger car business.
And people are telling me, I don't use Uber's cars, but apparently prices have been going up, but there's all another bunch of externalities like gas prices. There's all sorts of things that, like, you know, could make those prices go up too, but they should just add the fees to pay for bikes to the cars and have the cars subsidize the low carbon transit. Right.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we've seen, as far as we're like so far afield on your story,
we're already into the first item.
One of the things that we know has been happening as they try to make the ride hailing business profitable is, or at least not like the world record setting money loser that it currently is.
And that earnings call was
crazy. That they are actually like not that they're increasing the cost of a ride, but that they're reducing the amount that they're giving to drivers.
Yes,
and so we've seen strikes related to that in LA for both Lyft and Uber. And we have a major landmark bill that's making its way through the Sacramento legislature right now. Assembly Bill 5 from Lorena Gonzalez out of San Diego, who is a major pro-labor voice in the assembly. And that bill basically would make concrete something that the judicial system in the state found last year, which is that basically any gig economy employee should be considered an employee and not an independent contractor if they meet a certain set of criteria that that all Lyft and Uber drivers would fall under. So now we have reports that Lyft and Uber are trying to pressure their drivers to get in contact with the legislature and stop them. They're indicating that they would reduce people's hours, that they would strictly enforce regulations about being able to work with other companies, for example, if this bill is to pass. Basically just putting the pressure on their drivers, as they have been in terms of the take-home pay that they've been getting, but putting the pressure on them to say, we have the ability to make things worse for you
if you
allow this to go through. Or
New York City has introduced all these things. They have a surcharge. They're fighting to get a fair wage for these drivers, which is great. And it's a model that we could definitely do something like that. Again, like these are things we actually can do.
New York City lapping us.
I know. New York
week,
City
really.
Also, the state of New York also passing a very comprehensive rent control and tenant protection. Yeah, they can write all the bad articles about us they want to because they are this far superior part of the country right now. But one last thing I just want to say about bikes and scooters. So the interesting thing about this, you know, the response from Jump about why it costs them so much money to operate now because we have to have the scooters cleared off for these, you know, 2-hour requests. Again, the city council made this rule without really, I feel like, thinking about the implications here. And once again, not giving us the infrastructure. Once again, Paul Koretz in council chambers this week, like, you know, wagging his finger at the scooters, but hasn't put any safe bike infrastructure. Put in a really nice little crossing over La Brea this week. That could be a model. Keep on that one. But hasn't put in the lanes. And we need the lanes. And we also need the places to park the bikes and the scooters on the street, not on the sidewalk.
Not on the sidewalk.
Every single like crosswalk area should have that little space where you can't park a car to where somebody is supposed to walk across the street. A nice little bulb out area with bollards, places to park your own bike or someone else's bike. And that will serve as like a great signifier of that's where these go. So don't put them in front of the bus stop where people have to like get on the bus. That would save us so much time and money and put the lanes in to connect everybody and stuff you get around.
It is amazing that we have like our decrepit old sidewalks that are like...
Oh, I thought you were going to start talking about the city council.
We have sidewalks that are too narrow. We have sidewalks that are buckled, that are hazards for people with disabilities. And they are still just like the dumping ground for everything because that's the politically safest place to do it. Put it in the street. Allow for parking in the street. I think you're absolutely right. There's no excuse for not doing that.
Let's take our listeners to the city council floor now that you... mention it. We should have a theme song for the segment where we play clips from the city council so people can know when to turn off the show. So a theme song and a title for the segment is what we need eventually. Yes. But there was a meeting this week, a council meeting, to discuss a controversial, as it was referred to many times, a bill that's going through the assembly. This is AB 516. It was put up by David Chu in the Bay Area. And it's basically a ban on what they call poverty towing. Yep. Any car that is parked for 72 hours in any spot, it is legal to tow. You know about this if you left your car, if you went on vacation for 3 days and left your car in a spot, someone in your neighborhood is aware of the 72-hour rule and either called it in on you or left a little note under your windshield. It's like, actually, it's a law. I'll leave this here for more than 3 days. And basically, the effect of this law is for many, many people that either live in their cars or their cars break down and they can't afford to fix them, the cost of towing ends up being hundreds of dollars, and it's not something that people can afford to pay. The longer your car is in a lot, the more expensive it is, and so you basically just have to leave it there and or pay and end up in a much more precarious financial situation. So David Chu is trying to remedy this, and it's kind of LA's first big opportunity to show kind of a new seriousness on homelessness, to show that there are alternatives to the criminalization tactics that they have taken over the past couple years. And basically they, not to spoil it, but they declined the opportunity to try something else. There was a 12-1 vote in favor of basically, it doesn't do anything except they disapprove of this measure.
Yeah. So the city does weigh in on laws making their way through or bills making their way through the legislature quite frequently. Of course, they unanimously opposed SB 50. That was the most high profile one this session. But they do this with some regularity. And I don't think it's clear that anyone in the legislature cares necessarily.
Well, I have a response to that.
Okay.
Let's do a little back and forth. This is from gun-toting council member Greg Smith, who is sitting in CD12 pending their election that's happening now. And this is him talking about the city council.
If you think these people don't care, you are misadvised. You are wrong. They care passionately, and they're working every single day to find solutions to these issues. But for us to take away our ability as a city to tow away vehicles that are violating the law is really destroying our ability to keep our communities clean and safe. We care about those 36,000 people, but we also have 4 million other people we care about too, and they have to have a voice.
Hold for applause.
Hold for thunderous applause in the council chambers from the great people of CD12 that have traveled all the way to
this
CD12.
Quote makes me so fucking mad. I honestly, I am furious just like listening to him say that, like, we
need to recall this. Oh, wait.
He just all lives mattered. Homelessness. He really
didn't
did.
Even. He said like those actually don't matter.
He
only
said
the
right,
other
there's
people
only a few of them, and
we care about homelessness, but we care about the 4 million other Angelinos is not only like a false dichotomy, like homeless people to
our people
to segment them
people.
Out of the population yeah. of Angelinos is. Egregious. I would say if he were running for an office, which he's not, I would say it should be disqualifying for being part of the LA City Council, especially at a moment when the homelessness crisis is overtaking all attempts to address it. It is absurd to think that you could actually go up there and say to defend your action to force homeless people who are living in their cars onto the street by saying, I'm doing this because I have so much empathy for people who are in houses mm-hmm. is disgusting. And, you know, like Yosemite Sam, Craig Smith should just put his gun away and just fucking shut up. This is crazy.
It also shows the value of Craig Smith on the council to be simultaneously like a hype man who could be like, the rest of the council is awesome. And they really care about this stuff. And also someone who can put up motions like this at no cost.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He did put this up. Right. He's going to be gone in a few months.
Right.
And there's no
nobody voted
retribution
for him.
Yeah, exactly. So having someone like that on the council at all times, as there probably will be the case for eternity, as people just like drop out of right. this job that they don't care about just whenever they want. It's like he plays a seemingly kind of important role for them right now. Let's also hear from Paul Krikorian in the second district.
This bill would, Mr. Blumenfield spent a great deal of time working on trying to stop mobile billboards in the city, as did I when we were here. So what's to stop now our streets from being filled with more, you know, topless maid vans and all the other things that we see now, you know, if we can't tow cars away because they haven't been moved for 72 hours.
This I love.
I mean,
so
I,
on brand.
That's what
him.
I, the most of my 311 requests brand. Are topless maid vans parked out in front of my house. I mean, I have to say.
And now people are living, being forced to live in the topless maid van.
That doesn't sound so bad, but.
Oh my God. This is like.
Wait, should we explain the context of this? I'm sure we've mentioned it before, but Paul Krikorian has like a personal vendetta against the topless maid van. They are mortal enemies. he tried to get rid of it in his district, and the topless maids van changed. They redirected the number, which is like 1-800-669-HUGE or something, to his office.
Yeah.
And so work was completely shut down for days as they tried to figure out what to do about this, as people are like tying up the phone lines. I guess people are calling this number all the time.
So it is you should just be aware that this saga is still unfolding in city council.
Incredible.
But wait, relating it to mobile billboards also is what I really like. I mean, is this, you're trying to say that like
it's
somebody,
this is a major ongoing political situation in the San Fernando Valley. This is one of the only issues that San Fernando council members
ever talk about.
Yes. Bob Blumenfield is frequently making mention of the mobile billboard situation. Paul Krikorian is doing it here to bring it up.
In this context.
Of people living in their vehicles. And also the day that this is being talked about, it was like 95 degrees.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. I mean, just think about that for a minute.
To be talking
about this.
We should be able to seize people's vehicles if they're unable to pay their registration, because if we don't, there will be a state of lawlessness emblematized by the presence of topless maid vans is so disconnected from reality that, again, I feel like you just kind of wonder, what city is Paul Krikorian actually living in, and why is it not Los Angeles?
the people living in their cars will just be able to spray paint Jersey Mike's like on the side of the car.
They can sell new ad buys. Yeah.
A mobile billboard.
That's great.
Let's also hear from Nuri Martinez. This one was pretty wild to me.
Mr. Smith, thank you very much for bringing this, introducing this resolution here this morning. I know it's very controversial. I heard all the speakers, but I really am compelled to speak up for my district. I know a lot of you came from different parts of my district, but the majority of the people that I represent, unfortunately, are not here. They're not here because they're working, because they wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, get in their vehicles and work a 10, 11 hour shift. They're not here because a lot of them are single moms with three kids who are barely able to make ends meet because they hold two jobs. They're not here because, unfortunately, they don't have babysitters. They're not here because they're trying to figure out how to get by every single day just like the rest of us.
So there is no connective tissue ever established between this imaginary constituent and the issue of taking away people's cars because they can't pay their registrations, which would seem to be a possible threat to a single mother who is like has to work multiple jobs and is like paycheck to paycheck.
I mean, this is something that we see deployed in a number of contexts, I think, to suggest the bizarrely, in this case in particular, people showing up to homeless advocates, showing up to city council, volunteering to spend hours and hours out of their day to say that the city council should not do this thing.
What they're supposed to do and what the city council encourages people to do. And like earlier this week, Herb Wesson brought Chris Pine into the council chambers, let him sit in the big chair because he wanted to see how city government works, and tweeted a picture of him and Chris Pine and was like, everyone come on down to city council, like see how it works. And then you show up and your council member says, hey, get a job, deadbeat.
But she was trying to make the case that like her constituents weren't there because they were working, but that if they were there, they would have voiced their concern for the
but
RVs.
She doesn't say that.
No, but that's what's insinuated.
This is the insinuation that's being made. I think it's frankly an extremely insidious line of reasoning to say, if you show up and I want to ignore the thing that you're saying.
Right. Because a lot of activists showed up and said, you're criminalizing these people. Be like, this is going to throw people into homelessness. It's going to like end
well,
up.
Well, also the Valley has, in addition to the mobile billboards, is very well known for having entire streets, and this is part of stories that we've seen, with families living in RVs and trucks. There are photos of it. You can see where these places are. I mean, it's one of those places. It's like the hidden home and the garages, you know, the stories that we've seen. So how could you really not ignore, especially when you're trying to make the argument about single moms? I mean, that it was just like such a whiplash to hear.
Yeah.
To see the vote come in
right.
at the end,
this,
right?
This is all I think I can say about Nuri Martinez's comments is that what she's doing is she is using a class-based line of reasoning, namely, you people who showed up to this meeting are better off than my constituents who are not represented here.
Yes.
And you are not, you, the people being present to comment on this, who don't want to criminalize the homeless, are not representative of the average person in my district. She's using that as cover to make a directly class-based attack on her own constituents.
Yes.
Who also aren't there because they're working and then going to live in their car.
And then going home to live in their cars. So she is using class rhetoric to basically smokescreen the fact that she is being very classist and attacking her own constituents.
And it's something you can say about any measure you want to put forward.
Right.
In almost all cases, most of your district will not be present at the city council meeting. So you can apply whatever imaginary opinion you
want. I'm going to start using that for my articles. Well, the people I wanted to interview were busy.
What
I think they're going to say. But okay, so here's a great solution. Fine. If we criminalize it, that's okay if we give people places to park their vehicles overnight.
Or live.
Park their homes. Sorry. Yes. I was on the War on Cars podcast this week, and it was all about kind of the idea in New York that they're based in New York, but they don't really see this as much because obviously it gets cold and, you know, it's not as car centric city. So it's actually probably a little bit harder. But this idea that you could provide people a safe place to park, call it safe parking, perhaps.
That's a good
right.
And you could do that all over the city in places that we have a lot of parking lots. And then you could say that you want people to crack down on truly illegally parked vehicles as long as you provided a place all over the city where people could safely live.
Here's what they did instead. The city council on the same day voted to extend the existing 6-month ban on sleeping overnight in your cars because they just fucking hate homeless people.
Yeah.
They really do.
I assume that one was unanimous. I'm not sure exactly what happened with that vote.
Even
I think Mike Bonin, we should say, was the one person who voted.
And Mike Bonin does have safe parking at his office. He does have safe parking.
I want to come back to that in a second, but I do think that it's important to note that even in our responses from elected officials from the homeless count, I think that this was in, I mean, I might be wrong, so I might have to come back and correct myself, but I believe it was in Bob Blumenfield's response to the homeless count. He brought up this issue of quality of life in his response to exploding numbers of people living on our streets. So that's how you get a unanimous action to extend a ban on people being able to live in their cars. Because what you're really saying is homelessness is not a problem in and of itself. It's really a problem because it's an inconvenience and an eyesore for the people who have homes in
my
district.
When they say quality of life, they never mean
for people,
the impact on quality of life of not having shelter.
Which is, you know, like there was somebody, a homelessness activist, who actually spent some time living on the street earlier this year. I believe he was a member of a church, and he was like living on the street in Pasadena. And it was like, wow, this is extraordinarily, among all of the other aspects of homelessness that we know about, it's just it's basically a torturous exercise to be living on the street.
Especially right now. Now it's worse than ever. Yeah. Can I segue into something that I was dealing with this week? I was getting mad online about this. There are cooling centers set up around LA. We had a heat wave this week where it got up to like 99, basically, in parts of the city. I think it broke 100 in June.
In the valley, it was over 100.
Yes. And when that happens, there are places around the city designated cooling centers where people can go, and there's plenty of seating, and they need to have water and fans and all this stuff so people don't die of heat stroke, which happens all the time around the city, especially for senior citizens. It's really bad for children. So I was trying to find part of this group I work with. We were going to create basically a handout to show where all the cooling centers are. I was trying to Google LA city cooling centers, and I found links from the state website, the county website, and the city website, and all three were broken. Three different 404 error pages.
Yep.
And so I was tweeting at the county and stuff, and to some county person's credit, they built a map of cooling centers and had it up like the next morning.
Nice. Oh,
the fastest turnaround I've ever seen.
Thank you, county.
Like that, to fulfill the basic requirements of county government. But then the city was basically like, any public facing building is a cooling center. So like, we don't need to make a list or whatever. Go to the library, go to a rec center, go to something like that. So we were putting together this list basically of sites that Mitch O'Farrell's office gave out as public facing buildings that function as cooling centers, and called these places, like, for example, the Bellevue Rec Center by the park in this area.
Right.
And they said, oh, yeah, we're a cooling center, except when there's summer camp going on.
Oh, yeah. I was just about to say that summer camps are happening there. And
which
the
is Monday
is
through Friday.
Yeah, that's not
from
a cooling center.
10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Yeah, you can't go in. You can barely even go in there because there's so many sports practices going on in general. So
yes.
I would say that is not a cooling center. And so it's also not very good air conditioning in there.
No, a lot of these places do not have air conditioning, period.
Yeah, yeah.
They have the fans and water, but they're not air conditioned. So somebody hauls themselves in 105 degree weather to the Bellevue Rec Center because the city said that was a place where they could go. And they say, oh, well, there's kids here. We can't put you somewhere. And we're trying, like, the people there, by the way, are great. And in response to this, are saying like, well, we might have like an anteroom where we can put people or something.
They're
like,
amazing,
we're trying to figure
there,
this
for
out.
Sure.
Yes.
I will also say Curbed has a map of free places to go that have air conditioning, and you should look that up. It's not an official cooling center, but we do have like big malls and things like that listed that are generally welcoming to people who are hot.
Yeah, so that's a great idea. But people have to come up with these.
Yeah,
kind
we
of
need to know. Yeah, and especially how are you going to get there on transit or with, you know, I mean, it's when the bus doesn't come for 30 minutes and you're standing outside.
And a lot of these places that do have summer camps there have the rule. When I was a tutor, if you go on like school grounds or like the grounds of a camp, you need to get a background check and get fingerprinted before you can go in somewhere.
Yeah.
And like there are all these barriers to air conditioning, just getting to a place that
is. At least they open the public pools earlier now. They used to not open them until the start of summer, June 22nd, but now they open the public pools. They opened them last weekend after the last day of school, just before that heat wave started. But just the connection between, like, why would you not have pools open when the schools are out?
Well, we just, I think the state just started discussing whether or not they were going to eliminate the notion of fire season because fire season is year round now.
Oh, so my.
Well, maybe they'll do the same for pool
for
season.
Pool season. Well, I mean, that is a big part of it. I went to Climate Resolve's wildfire conference on Friday, and that is basically the sentiment is fires happen all year round, and also that utilities are going to have to, I don't know if we talked about this before, but they're going to have to maybe start powering down in anticipation of the worst days, doing these like localized brownouts, or, you know, they've already actually started doing it in a few places where the fires have started. There are fires all over now happening already, but there's going to be, talking about cooling centers or things like this, like you won't even have a reliable sense of where the air conditioning might be if there's, say you're in the foothills and a fire starts, then what happens? Then it's 110 and you've got people, I don't even think the estimates of how many people are going to be killed or seriously ill from extreme heat count the fact that people are living outside in these conditions. Yep. I mean, you have to look at these figures that are already so mind-blowing, and we are in for the worst summer.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think suffice to say, we're not prepared for that, any of that.
Let me close. We're still on the city council floor. They really want us to leave. We're about to be hauled out by security, but I want to play this one. This is the continuation of the Nuri Martinez clip. It's very short.
You know, members, I sometimes scratch my head and I ask, what is Sacramento doing? So much of what's being dictated in Sacramento, they are completely out of touch with reality. They're not the ones who receive the complaints. They're not the ones to get the angry phone calls and the frustration that we see all across our city because we can't seem to solve this issue. They're not the ones who people are angry at. But yet they want to tell the city of Los Angeles and the rest of us how to govern. We govern the city of Los Angeles, not Sacramento.
I thought this was interesting in response to a lot of the rhetoric of last week after the homeless count, where basically every city council member pointed to the state as being responsible for these numbers. So it just really depends on the circumstance. Either they are handcuffed by the state and would like to govern the city on their own, but the state is responsible for all these housing policies that are causing homelessness, or they need to maintain the control that they already have because the state is trying to come in and say what they can and can't do. And also, at what point does weed govern the city of Los Angeles become?
Exactly.
That you don't want to brag about.
That was exactly what I wanted to say.
Cite your sources.
We govern the city of Los Angeles. How can you, in the same sentence, attempt to pass the buck so quickly and also claim to govern the city of Los Angeles? This is it's ridiculous. It doesn't make sense.
I also want to say about locally about safe parking stuff. Everyone at this meeting was talking about we need to put up safe parking and like places to put these people, which they can obviously do tomorrow. And specifically, I've talked about the Edendale Library before, where the CD13, Mitch O'Farrell's office, is putting together a safe parking program. He talked about it as one of his accomplishments in his email after the homeless count numbers came out. And basically, it turns out that the contractors and the library commission and everyone are ready to go on this and have been for a really long time.
Yeah.
And the city is dragging its feet on basically just issuing the contract, just giving them a piece of paper to sign. And meanwhile, Garcetti was out there this week in his like letter to the city saying, like, businesses, we need you guys to like open up your parking lots that are underused to become safe parking facilities. Churches, we need everyone to get involved on this. And you have this one property, a library, where everything is good to go.
Yeah.
And the city doesn't have the sense of urgency to just like get this piece of paper to the people that want to start working on this. It's bad.
I mean, should we discuss that in the context of the Steve Lopez article? That,
well, let's talk. It was one of the things mentioned by the mayor in his letter to all Angelenos this week. It was a specific call out to safe parking.
But this is the thing, is Garcetti's letter that he sent out, definitely better than his previous response, which, as we discussed, really leaned strongly on the things are improving message, which was not necessarily borne out by the numbers that we saw come out, and was a kind of curious misstep in terms of the tone that he chose to use. He did send out this second statement that said, like, I get it, people are pissed off by my apparent nonchalance.
And related it to the earthquake called this the second worst natural disaster. Second worst disaster compared to the San Francisco earthquake. And I would say it's probably superseded this.
Oh, sure. It's killed way more deep. Why? Yep.
I mean, let's just think about, okay, go on.
But I think still, like you're saying, Hayes, there's a message that is kind of like, I'm taking the reins of leadership and I'm going to ask people to get involved in a way that it's not necessarily clear that that's been the main obstacle. It really does seem like it's been intransigence on the part of city council members, a general apathy by Angelenos at large, particularly homeowners who do view homelessness as, not all of them obviously, but yeah, generally speaking, view homelessness as a quality of life issue for themselves. And not a major social failure that is being waged every day against this segment of our population.
So that's where Nuri Martinez actually, I think, is correct in what she's saying. She talks about the calls that her office gets.
Right.
If those were a reflection of people's opinions about the homelessness crisis, I'm sure they lean violently towards criminalization and just getting rid of as many homeless people as possible. I don't believe that's how most people in the city actually feel, but in terms of the people that are loud about it and are speaking up, if you were a city council member, you would think that it was like a 90-10 issue in favor of...
You could even say that the vast majority of Angelenos are not calling Nuri Martinez's office because they're working.
Yes.
Because
that's what
they
I
have
say
jobs.
To her, even more people than your imaginary people are on my side.
But there was maybe, I mean, I think you're right. It was a very good letter. It was weird that it was a letter and not, I don't know, anything else. I mean, I got it like as from the press.
Yeah.
Office, and then the next day he made a video, or the next day. Anyway, there was some policy in it. There was additional resources going to HHH specifically for approvals, which I thought was interesting, like making sure more of these like sites could be moved forward. Again, like, I don't know why that wasn't part of the deal with the meeting. Yeah. And then a mention of this legal assistance fund, which had actually already been announced, but it's to help renters and evictions. But then the next section was kind of, like you said, these kind of just asks.
Yes,
like,
call to action.
I'm going to ask you to advocate for self-parking. I might ask you, or I might ask to use your parking lot, or I might ask you to hire someone who was formerly homeless, or I might ask you to, you know, things like that. And I just think we're, like you said, we're beyond asking. And it could have been something like, you know, we are putting safe parking lots in every neighborhood. Deal with it. It should have been deal with it at the end of every sentence, right? And then there was an interesting thing, I think, that came out after in the response to it. So the next day, Joe Buscaino posted a tweet that said, "My challenge to every city is to do what I've already done. Build one unit of supportive housing for every 1,000 residents in your city." And I don't know if he means council district or other cities, because he's shouting it out to the other. Yeah,
because he got into it with a Torrance city council member on Facebook.
Who were like, people who are supposedly pushing their homeless residents into their council district. So, but I took it also as, you know, a subtweet of other cities, but also a good challenge for the council districts. And I don't know if he's saying like my city, like Los Angeles, and I didn't look at these numbers here, but that seems like maybe where we should be going instead of this 2-2-2 goal by next year. I mean, I don't know. It's obviously these goals aren't working and people aren't meeting them, but there needs to be this kind of ratio of for every however many residents, like the frequency of libraries in the city or something like that. Like libraries are meant to serve a certain amount of residents all over the city. And like, we need safe parking for that many residents. We need a supportive housing. We need like a bridge housing center. We need more. It can't just be like, it has to be everywhere and it has to be soon.
I want to read a little bit of the Steve Lopez column from today, Saturday, that just came out. So last week, Steve Lopez ethered Eric Garcetti for his management of the homeless crisis. Garcetti texted him and was like, come talk to me and like see what my strategies are. And Steve Lopez said, okay. He wrote a column today that is not as savage as the last one, but there are a couple sections. He basically talks about like watching Garcetti run these meetings and say he does a good job and he's charismatic and he's good at convincing people to do things. He says, why is he running these meetings? Why isn't Christina Miller, the homelessness czar, doing it and briefing him on it? But I think he should be in these things and like, as Steve Lopez says, like whipping towels to people basically to like try and get them to act on stuff. But here's a paragraph from it. He says, I heard Garcetti say more than once last week that although the city's homeless numbers jumped 16%, the state number was twice as high. So the city is clearly doing something right. Watching him bask as first to serve staff and clients thanked him and took pictures, I wondered if this is what you do when dreams of higher office evaporate. When you campaign for a school parcel tax that goes down in flames, and when even the most compassionate of LA's residents wonder why you can't do more about the public health threat from mounds of trash near encampments, you delude yourself into thinking things are going pretty well. Rough stuff.
That is, yeah, that is really brutal. That is probably even harder than we've been on.
I mean, it's like it made me feel bad a little bit.
But there's undeniably an element of truth to that, I think, because we have seen, you know, as Garcetti has during the course of this year pivoted from what was obviously a mounting campaign for higher office to the realization that he is in LA for the foreseeable future. I think that we have seen him kind of be like, well, things are going okay, so maybe it's okay that I'm still here to, right. I mean, if you think about it, the last time that he was really checked in to city politics at the latest was during his re-election campaign. Even that's iffy, but that was an overwhelming victory for him, resounding 80%. It was basically uncontested. But, you know, the 80% vote for you, I think, would make people think that people like Garcetti, right? I think that was the big takeaway. So then I think he has kind of had to reacclimate himself to the state that the city is in 2019 and be like, oh, wow, a lot of people are actually really mad at me.
Yeah.
And that probably is coming as a bit of a surprise to him, if he, especially if he did have one foot out the door, as it appeared that he did.
I want to mention briefly, Inglewood passed a rent control cap this week. There's a group called Uplift Inglewood that seemingly single-handedly dragged this over the finish line. And not only did they get the rent cap passed, they got it lowered from 8% to 5%. They were going to pass it at 8%. And that is a huge difference. That's going to keep people in their homes.
Yeah.
They did it all on their own. And that's like something that other municipalities around LA can do, even with the restrictions of Casa Hawkins. They can pass sweeping rent control measures if they follow the example that that Inglewood did. We also got to talk about the vacancy tax.
Yeah.
Councilmember Mike Bonin basically put forward a motion this week to stop landlords from leaving units vacant, to tax them if they do that for too long. With an eye on filling units, creating more available housing for people. Didn't say specifically about what that tax would be used for. In some places, it's been connected to building housing for people who are homeless or low-income housing. Like Denver, I think, Alyssa, you've written about in the past.
They have a slightly different thing. It's not necessarily a vacancy tax, but they do, like, they put people into vacant units and subsidize the rent for them. So it's this idea that if there's, say, a luxury tower in your downtown that truly is half empty, you get the units out of that. And then a rental assistance fund makes up the difference to allow people to be able to live there.
I'm supportive of this. I think, first of all, I think we should say this has a questionable path to actually being implemented. The measure that the city council is considering right now is basically to study how they would do that. There are restrictions on local governments that attempting to introduce new taxes, special taxes that would, I mean, basically of any description based on the Prop 13 family of regulations. The easiest way to do it would be to put it before voters, and then,
which I think is the plan.
Yeah, I think we have to. Yeah, but 2020 is what they're saying. Yeah,
2/3, I would guess.
It would have to be 2/3. Yeah.
Okay, so that's tough.
But this is a popular concept because it doesn't mean any new units.
Well, there's two things I think is it doesn't. It probably won't like hurt anything. It's great. Like we should know how many units are vacant and why, and we don't. So the first step could be, you know, the numbers when they say empty units or our vacancy rate, which is very low, is a point in time. It's either census or, you know, it could be compiled all these different ways, but it's not completely, it's not like a survey of what is true at this moment and who owns what and why, if it's truly like investors or if it's truly empty or whatever. So the first step would be collecting the information. And if we had that information, then maybe we don't need the vacancy tax. Maybe we start to look at some different ways to fill the units or get people into certain housing near them or something like that.
Yeah. most of it is natural turnover. Any vacancy rate number is going to be like someone moved out, they're repainting, someone is moving in. It would be great to know which of these units are being held open for years.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing is that we, and this is something we've said in the past, it's not desirable to have zero vacancy. Having no vacancy is
also bad for renters.
Terrible for renters. That would be kind of in its own way a disaster. The vacancy tax will not lead to that, so I don't want to give that impression. I think that this is a good step. I think Bonin is right to propose it, but I also want to note that he's doing so in a context of rising homelessness, and it's not directly clear to me that this, like, if you are a landlord or whatever, you own a building and you're being affected by LA's new vacancy tax, that is not necessarily going to lead to you housing the homeless, right?
Probably not. I mean, I think it has basically the effect of opening up space for people and hopefully reducing the vacancy rate, increasing the vacancy rate so people could move in to places and like generally lowering rent. Some people say that it would raise rent. I mean, I don't really subscribe to that. I think it is good policy. It has been held up by a lot of people as kind of a be all and end all in terms of solving the housing crisis. And that is insane.
It's not true. Right. Yeah. I do think that I think that it's important to have context for the expectations for what a vacancy tax can do. I think the best case and the case that I believe Bonin is trying to make by tying this to our homelessness crisis directly is that what it can do is in the way that we do have in gentrifying areas, landlords basically evicting people for no reason other than that they're hoping they can get a higher paying tenant in there eventually without really having a timeline for when that might happen. This is something that happened to me in my former building in East Hollywood. A lot of those units, after they're turned over, gutted, etc., are going to sit vacant too for a number of months, just kind of by default. So this vacancy tax, if enacted, would, I think, help level the consideration of, are we going to just dump all of the existing tenants and then spend a year and a half, 2 years redoing the whole building and then the units sit vacant while we try and collect two or three times the current rent? Hopefully it discourages that behavior and thereby can hopefully help people to not fall into homelessness by avoiding some of these predatory evictions. But it's not going to lead to the lowest of the lowest income people finding new housing.
Right.
I think the bigger thing too that I see is like people, the Prop 13 homeowners who bought their houses a long time ago and maybe rented them for a while or didn't, and they, you know, they just don't care because the house is so cheap to just keep vacant or underutilized. So if you could motivate the people who maybe do have empty properties, and I would say also commercial empty properties, because it's the same thing
Absolutely.
All over the city.
Look at Westwood Village. Yeah. Some of those places have been vacant for like 5 years.
Yep. And this is something too that council districts could proactively do. They could go identify sites in their in their own districts and say, hey, you know, before we do this vacancy tax thing, like, let's find out the information about why these places are empty and if we could do housing there.
I have breaking news. Oh. During this podcast record, my friend Mike O'Shea, who works with CELA, our neighborhood homeless advocacy group, and is kind of our representative in the Services Not Sweeps initiative, sent an email that so LA Sanitation, LA San, is kind of on the front lines on a lot of encampment sweeps, obviously. All the pictures you see of like the big dump trucks and like people hauling tents into them and things like that. And so they put together a deployment plan for their expansion of the Clean Streets, Operation Healthy Streets, and Hope Team programs. And they basically endorsed a model that kind of reflects what Services Not Sweeps has been saying. This is LA Sanitation.
This was also in the mayor's letter. It wasn't really a policy outline, but this sounds like policy is following it, perhaps.
In their report, they say, too often we hear that homeless encampment cleanups can inadvertently set people back on their pathway to housing through the accidental loss of key documents or through the stress of unpredictable engagements with city teams, which can lessen trust over time. Unbelievable to see that sentence in an LA sanitation report. That's crazy.
Yep.
And they recommend a robust public health infrastructure, expansion of the pit stop program, which are like the toilets and hygiene centers near encampments, coordination with encampments for self-management of waste disposal, and more mental health training for frontline LA sand workers. Pretty wild.
That's great.
That's really good news.
Yeah, LA has been behind on this, so I think these are exactly the kind of changes that we need to make.
I'm so happy to be able to end on
and,
something like that.
Slightly positive note. Yes. That's great.
Hasn't happened in weeks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the show. Thanks, Ian, for delivering my helmet to me. Everyone else, bring me stuff this week who's listening. And we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.